Princess's white piano, he allowed himself to think, as the tigers would have done, "Here comes the beast and beauty." The breath of the tigress was wonderfully foul because of the putrid remains of breakfast still stuck between her teeth. That was the only thing that jarred. All the tigers were on their hind legs now, waltzing as in a magic ballroom in the country where the lemon trees grow. The bars of the arena went past, first one by one, then as the tempo quickened, resolving themselves into one single blurred bar, a confinement apprehended but no longer felt, until that single bar itself dissolved, and all that remained was the limitless landscape of the music within which, while the dance lasted, they lived in perfect harmony. This time, the applause was tumultuous, and if the princess herself joined in, so did every single member of the circus, with the exception of the sulking Charivaris. For as Walser took his bow, he saw all the stable boys, roustabouts and grooms, besides elephants and equestrians he could not put a name to, unknown tumblers, jugglers, girls who were shot from guns, and every single clown, all drawn to the amazing spectacle, all succumbed to it. The colonel sank right down in his seat and kicked his little legs in the air with delight. Feathers toasted Walser with the empty brandy bottle. Walser led the tigress back to her pedestal and bowed to her. She knocked him backwards with her rumbling, gratified, evil-smelling purr. Exquisitely formal, the princess kissed him on both cheeks, but Mignon she kissed on the mouth. And the two girls clung together for a little longer, only a moment longer than propriety allowed, although such was the vigour of the ovation, nobody noticed, except those to whom it came as no surprise. Then the princess snapped shut the piano lid, took up her rifle, and gestured imperiously with it. The cats leapt off their pedestals and disappeared down the chute. Abruptly discontinuous, the enchantment was over. The colonel was well pleased with the progress of the August he had himself selected, who was now both human chicken and tigress's gigolo. But later that afternoon, the strong man beat Walser to a pulp, and only the intervention of the aerialiste saved him. The cuckolder cuckolded with a double set of horns. The strong man's forehead buckled under the weight. He lurked in the gamey tranquillity of the menagerie, biding his time until Walser passed through the bowels of the building on his way to piss in the courtyard, and jumped upon him from behind, knocking him down on the cobbles in front of the elemental indifference of the elephants. Walser's coxcomb and wig fell off. The strong man knelt on Walser's back and kneed his kidneys again and again, but you would have thought it hurt him more than it hurt Walser, because he blubbered like a child. Walser, his right arm useless, could do nothing to defend himself, and writhed under the great grunting succubus until a drench of water descended on them both. That put the strongman's fire out. He rolled off Walser, bawling and dripping, a sorry sight. This time it was Feathers who flourished the hosepipe, with which the princess had already rescued Walser once before. She shook out her last few drops in a disturbingly masculine fashion, and laid it aside. Mignon looked out of the cat house at the sound of the commotion. When she saw Samson, the strong man, reduced to such pathetic, liquefying misery, her face took on an April hue of sympathetic showers. She had too short a memory to hold a grudge. Walser, ignored, got up and looked for his head coverings. Water ran out of his sleeves and down his trouser legs. Feathers shooed the ex-combatants towards the princess's quarters, although when the strong man saw the tigers perking up and looking inquisitive, he began to bellow again, this time out of fright. He was dressed as usual only in his tiger-skin loincloth, to which the princess pointed meaningfully. "What she means is, off with that," Feathers said to him. "They don't like the look of it." He knuckled his eyes and would not budge, so she removed it for him, disclosing for a moment his enormous prick, now crouched and shrunken, altogether the ghost of itself, before she wrapped him in a towel and chucked his loincloth to a safe distance. Walser made haste to take off his own trousers before, oh, agonizing, oh, delirious notion, she could get her hands on him. Soon, both were draped in towels and seated on bottles of straw. It was 4 o'clock, and Mignon ran to the freshly opened cookhouse for warming mugs of tea. Mignon's ball dress hung from a bar on a wooden hanger marked Hôtel de l'Europe. At home, the cat tamers looked like a pair of schoolgirls surprised at a game in the dorm. Like the princess, Mignon didn't bother to dress up in private, although her underthings were brand new, exquisite batiste and broderie anglaise. A price tag still hung from the petticoat hem. The strong man took a swallow of tea, and then his tears burst forth afresh. Feathers, with impersonal motherliness, took his curly head in her arms and pillowed it on her bosom. Walser was aggrieved, for he was the battered one, and nobody paid him any attention, except Mignon, who, discovering hitherto untapped areas of competence within herself, snatched up a beefsteak and slapped it on his face to quell the beginnings of a monstrous black eye. But hers was not the attention he craved, and the more the strong man sobbed and snuggled, the more Walser felt put in the wrong and ill-used. "I never laid a finger on her," he declared to the strong man, only to spark off a fresh storm. The strong man mumbled something between Feather's breasts, where only she could hear. "He says he loves you," she told Mignon. Mignon presented a blank face. Feathers hastily translated herself. Mignon laughed. The strong man wept and mumbled some more. "He says he loves you, but he's a coward." This time, Mignon did not laugh, but kicked at the straw with her bare toe. Mumble, mumble, mumble. "He says he loves you, he's a coward, and he can't bear to think of you in the arms of a clown." It was the princess who burst out laughing this time, while Mignon shook her head.
"No, never a clown."
The strong man brightened up at that and managed to get his tea down. The word iron was crudely inscribed on the knuckles of his right hand and steel on his left. The tattoos had a miserably self-inflicted look, as if carved with a penknife, then filled in with ink, during a deprived self-mutilatory childhood. All of his bulk was muscle and simplicity. There was no flesh, nor flab, nor wit on him. He had a good snub nose, and, as he left off snivelling, his face once again took on its habitual expression of baffled innocence, of perpetual wonder at the ways of the world. The strong man was naive and knew no tricks. During the gaps between the acts, while the cage or the trapeze went up, or the clowns mugged, Samson would strut round the ring, holding a horse above his head. Yes, he was very strong, and, as he knew deep down, a spiritual weakling. But, and this is what he did not know about himself, he was a great sentimentalist, so that all the time he was poking the ape-man's woman, he never thought much about her, except that she was easy. But as soon as she went off with a clown, or so he thought, and took a bath, had her hair done, put on a pretty dress, turned into a star, his heart turned over like a pancake whenever he thought how he'd get his huge tool in her no more. But don't think great loves haven't sprung from less likely sources than that in the history of the world. If, when the strong man watched the tiger waltz Mignon out of his reach forever, he thought his heart was breaking, sentimental he might have been, but break, it did. Out of the fracture, sensibility might poke a moist, newborn head. As all sat inconclusively around the cat house, came a dragging, bumping sound. The professor entered, backwards, through the open door to the courtyard, pulling the insensible ape-man along by his feet. The professor was making heavy weather of it, panting, blowing and wheezing, clearly painfully conscious of the indignity of his task. The ape-man's head thudded against the cobbles at each tug the professor gave his boots, but the smile on his insensible features did not lift.
"Mein husband," said Mignon.
Here, Samson, me old duck, you go and give that poor hairy fellow a hand before he has a heart attack, said Feathers.
The strong man rose obediently, tucking the ends of his towel round his waist. He carted the ape-man off to his bunk, the professor trotting along beside him, chattering to himself with annoyance. Feathers dropped some remark in German that made Mignon smile, another in French that made the princess smile too, but they did not smile at Feathers, they smiled at one another. And one white hand and one brown one reached out and clasped together.
That's that, then. At last, she addressed Walser. You cop hold of your duds and come along with me, old China. Leave the lovebirds together.
Lovebirds, was it?
Of course it was.
Hand in hand, the girls now went back into the cage, where the tigers slept the afternoon away. For the princess was teaching Mignon more lieder. So she would not sing in the ring. Well and good. So much the better, in fact. They would cherish in loving privacy the music that was their language, in which they'd found the way to one another. When the strong man came running back from the apes, he, love locked out, shook the bars that kept him from his beloved, but the musical lovers did not hear, so rapt were they. Left alone, the professor went through the pockets of the ape-man. He withdrew his flat wallet, found what he was looking for, Monsieur Lamarque's contract with the colonel, read it through, and tore it up. He pierced the unconscious ape-man with a regard of pure, simian contempt. He seized the ape-man's greatcoat from the foot of his bunk in order to pass unnoticed in the crowd, and sped off. In the courtyard, he discovered Walser, sluicing his face for the second time that day, getting rid of blood and muddied makeup. The professor caught his bad arm, making him jump, and after a tetchy display of contrition, drew Walser with him into the alley. Although Walser, wearing only a towel, protested fiercely, he made it apparent he wished the clown to hail a cab for him. Since the colonel proposed to entertain his star to dinner that night, a date of which he nourished great hopes, he returned to his hotel early, in order to treat his blue jowls to a shave. In his rolled shirt sleeves humming, Casey Jones, to himself around his clenched cigar, he was attacking his cheeks with a cutthroat razor in the bathroom of his suite, when the professor, in too much of a hurry to fuss with the front desk, shinned up a drainpipe and knocked peremptorily at the frosted glass window. The colonel, after a few exclamations of Kentuckian astonishment, let the professor in and ushered him to the drawing-room to wait while he wiped the suds from his cheeks. When he returned, the professor was seated at the writing-desk, penning rapidly on hotel notepaper. Netta did not give me vocal cords, but left the brain out of Monsieur Lamarque. He is a hopeless drunk with no business sense. I, therefore, propose to take over all the business management of the educated apes and demand the salary and expenses formerly payable to Monsieur Lamarque now be paid to me.
Well, here's the do, Sybil, Colonel Carney addressed his pig. The madmen take over the lunatic asylum.
Undeterred, the chimp jotted down the sum he considered appropriate for the services of himself and his colleagues, which caused the colonel's eyebrows to rise when he saw it and offer the professor a friendly glass, hardly the most tactful hospitality in the circumstances, which the professor angrily refused. Uncorking a fresh bottle of bourbon with his teeth, the colonel stroked a chin still stiff with soap and observed amusedly,
"Ah, shoot, Professor! If there ain't a man in the ring with you, people'll think you're just a bunch of high school kids in monkey suits."
The professor uttered an indescribable noise that did not need vocal cords to express its meaning.
"I'll thank you to keep a civil tongue in your head, Professor. Well, sir, you know what I always say. Let us consult the oracle."
With a grunt, Sybil launched herself to the carpet as he spilled out the alphabet cards.
"Cheap at the price," pondered the colonel. "Well, I hate to disagree with you, Sybil, but this gentleman certainly strikes a mighty hard bargain. Are you convinced he's irreplaceable? You are? I'll be darned.
He squinted at Sybil ruminatively, assailed by the first doubts of her integrity, that there might be some solidarity among the dumb beasts, that they could form a pact of some kind against him, was a disturbing possibility that hitherto never entered his mind. Finally, he grudgingly extended his hand to the professor.
A gentleman's handshake is his bond where I come from. Oh, I see, not where you come from. Well?
Reluctantly, he sat down at the desk and wrote out a new contract. But even so, he was forced to strike out a brace of clauses and allow the professor to attach a codicil before the chimp would sign. Refusing so much as a bite of one of Sybil's apples to clinch the deal, the professor roared off, by the door this time, leaving the colonel much vexed.
"Pork and beans!" he threatened Sybil. "Spare ribs! Hickory smoked ham!"
But she jumped back upon her cushion and closed her eyes purposefully, brooking no further discussion, although the colonel might have concluded his shave with even less equanimity had he known that, in the foyer, on his way out, the professor had enlisted the aid of a passing Lizzie in obtaining from the desk clerk a copy of Cook's International Rail Timetable. Chapter 9. To wash down the caviar, stuffed pancakes and sour cream, the jellied carp, marinated mushrooms and smoked salmon, the colonel preferred bourbon to vodka. After that, he found bourbon made the borscht go down better. Feathers had some white burgundy with the first course, red burgundy with the soup, and plied her silverware with a will. An old hand at seduction dinners, she believed in making a hearty meal, and the colonel spared no expense. Roast goose with red cabbage and apples? She passed on that, however, choosing venison instead, and changed to a chateau-bottled claret. The colonel stuck to bourbon, and now confined his eating to crumbs from the bread rolls, which he agitated with nervous fingers. Feathers, however, found room for ice cream to finish up, plus a glass of Chateau d'Yquem, belched companionably, and nodded when he, red-faced and already over-primed for the occasion, offered her a good-night nightcap in his suite. She enjoyed well-chilled champagne, while the impresario lapsed into slumber on the couch beside her. Removing the bourbon bottle from his fist, she poked curiously into the aperture of his fly, which he'd just fumbled open before he passed out, and withdrew a string of little silk American flags. Sybil gave a reproachful grunt.
"How did it go?"
inquired Lizzie, in their own drawing-room, thick with the scent of hothouse flowers and the smell of the melted wax, which the old woman was carefully dripping from a candle. She looked as if she were performing a witchcraft ritual, but such was far from the case.
"Couldn't get his star-spangled banner up," replied Feathers. "Britannia's revenge for the War of 1812. I say, oh, Liz, ain't you done with your invisible writing yet?" "It'll be ready for his next consignment," said Lizzie equably.
Feathers drew back the brocade curtain and looked out at a frozen little crescent moon that lay on its back in the vast sky. She sighed.
"Seems a shame to play a trick like that on such a nice young man." "Not hatched out yet," Lizzie summed him up. "The clowns may pelt him with eggs as if eggs cost nothing, but his own shell don't break yet. He's too young for you, my girl. He's living proof that travel don't broaden the mind. Instead, it renders a man banal."
"Not his mind as interests me," said Feathers.
"Oh, Sophie, you're a devil for a pretty face."
"Not his face as interests me."
A rap on the door interrupted her. A yawning bellboy delivered a fragrant, precious mound of out-of-season Parma violets. Her lucky flower. She exclaimed with surprise. How did the unknown sender know that? Lizzie snatched the card that came with them, read it, compressed the corners of her mouth, and tossed it into the fire. But Feathers, greedily investigated the moist ribbon-wrapped stalks of the flowers with her capable nurse's hands, and discovered a shagreen box. Inside the box, to Lizzie's further displeasure, glittered a diamond bracelet like a cold bandage.
"A pretty face is one thing, our Liz," opined Feathers, trying on the bracelet at once, "but diamonds is another. Is a punter good for a touch?"
Her pupils narrowed down to the shape of pound signs. Chapter 10. After the dizzy triumph of the grand gala opening, Feathers grew sick of flowers, even violets, and told the doorman of the Hôtel de l'Europe to redirect her floral tributes to the lying-in hospital. Deluged with invitations, she permitted herself to accept only one single supper, and that for the final night of the engagement. This invitation came accompanied by a shagreen box, twin of the one that brought the diamond bracelet, containing a pair of diamond earrings, the size of hazelnuts, and a note promising a necklace to match on the evening in question. Therefore, she concluded, this punter was prepared to put his money where his mouth was, or rather, where his mouth hoped to be. On the final night, as it happened, Buffo the Great, having hearkened to the voice of drunken Russia, went out to celebrate his departure from the capital of vodka together with the ape man. The saturnine Frenchman, the first casualty of the party, succumbed in a low dram shop, was piled to one side like so much lumber, and there abandoned. Little Ivan, it was, anxiously searching the back-alley bars, who found Buffo, still on his feet though wavering, and led him back to Clown Alley, there to settle him on an upturned stool before a rectangle of cracked mirrors, where Buffo flailed about, wriggled, moaned and struggled to prevent Grick and Grock repairing the ravages his debauch had made upon his makeup. For he presented a deplorable sight. His natural skin showed through his matte white in ghastly streaks and runnels, and in the course of his peripatetic carousing, he had mislaid his bald piece, so that a mean fringe of coarse graying hair, spiked with sweat, surmounted a piebald face that seemed, rather than its customary mask-like inhumanity, now hideously, partly human. Grick and Grock clucked, gibbered, and wrung their hands at the state into which the master clown had got himself, but Buffo was well away and bellowed like a bull.
"Tonight shall be my Calvary. God will make 'em split their sides."
He had the air of a revenant, back from the grave, in flapping cerement stained with dung, mire and vomit, but he was stubbornly, indeed dementedly, still bent upon a spree. He drained a bottle from his pocket as he swayed before the mirror. Grick and Grock ferreted out another bald piece for him, and cocked a fresh conical hat at a rakish angle. That pleased him for some reason, and he puckered up his rouged lips at himself in the mirror, pouted like a young girl, and then, all at once, his bowels opened, and Grick and Grock ran squeaking off for water and scrubbing brush and a fresh pair of drawers. But, at the great clown's request, little Ivan trotted away in the other direction to fetch another pint of vodka. The colonel, in the box office counting out the takings, pooh-poohed Walter's account of Buffo's obscene and perilous condition.
"Drunker he is, the funnier he is."
He stuffed a last handful of rainbow-coloured banknotes in the cash box and locked it up with a pleased expression on his face, for it was
"house full and standing room only tonight."
Once again, and there were more Grand Dukes, Archduchesses, princes and princesses in the audience that night of nights than the Colonel himself had consumed fried chicken dinners in his entire life. As the band started in on the March of the Gladiators, the Colonel's heart filled with a kind of holy awe. To have provided for such an illustrious gathering so rich a banquet of astonishment, and to have coined so much profit from it. He felt himself both to be glorified and also the entrepreneur of glory. Above his scrubby head floated an invisible halo, composed of dollar bills. The circus parade passed off without any untoward occurrence, Bufo's lurching gait and uncoordinated gesticulations of arms and legs went unnoticed among the antics of the other clowns, who were so concerned to cover for him that each excelled himself in outlandish capers, leaps, and pratfalls. When Bufo tripped over a poodle, it was the work of a moment for Grick and Grock to seize either end of his disarticulated carcass and go into an improvised version of the clown's funeral, wiping imaginary tears from their eyes with lavish gestures of their flowing sleeves. Bufo kept rearing and bucking away between his pallbearer's shoulders, as if he were having so much fun in his death throes that he simply couldn't bear to stop, while his shrill, ear-splitting voice stuttered out imprecations that, so long as you did not understand them, were funnier than you could have believed possible. Such thwarted fury, such incomprehensible rage. The clowns carried Bufo round the ring and off behind a section of high-stepping and contemptuous horses, who could spot a yahoo when they saw one, while Bufo cursed the world and all who dwelled therein, to the uncomprehending delight of all observers. They dumped him down in the menagerie to await the clown's last cue. He sent little Ivan running for another pint of vodka, and when it was time for the Feast of Fools, the clown's Christmas dinner, the Lord of Misrule himself, possessed as he was by the spirits in the bottle, went out of his mind. They bore the trestle table into the ring, and with their customary wealth of byplay, spread it with its white dust sheet, and laid it with the rubber knives and forks and plates, prodding, stabbing, and poking at each other the while, sufficient to procure gales of mirth. They took their places round the table, tucking their napkins into their neckbands, and the audience took time out to catch its breath. Bufo, in the wings, emptied the fresh bottle and tossed it aside. When he saw the glare of the arc lights, he covered his eyes with his hands and screamed.
"How? Don't you see?"
he cried to little Ivan.
"Hermione has turned to blood!"
But little Ivan spoke no English, and understood only Bufo's scream. Into the ring he staggered, the child tagging anxiously at his heels. His fresh makeup was already flaking, and his bald piece wrinkling up until it threatened to dislodge his cap. He picked up the carving knife and flourished it most horribly. From the tip floated an ominous knot of red ribbons. Little Ivan had the job of getting the blue butcher's apron on him, and skipped round and round the teetering colossus, now on one side, now the other, in order to push him back on his unstable balance each time he threatened to lose it. The audience burst its lungs when it saw him. As if not to laugh, would have provoked the most savage punishment. "Bufo the Great! Nobody like Bufo the Great!" Little Ivan steered and tugged him to the head of the table, and Bufo collapsed on his collapsing chair. If his ensuing wrestling bout with the chair had all the defiance and bravado of Jacob's with the angel, only the clown suspected that, tonight, the harmless chair had indeed assumed in Bufo's imagination the shape and form of some far-from-angelic adversary, and as he and the chair grappled with one another, the company around the table grew a little closer together, their tatterdemalion garments rustling as a wind of consternation blew through them, and then they, too, along with every child in the house, broke out in a great shout of pleasure and relief when Bufo finally, miraculously, got the chair down unprotesting on its 4 feet, smashed the seat flat with a crashing thwack of his palm, and, at long last, planted his bum thereon. Backstage, Walser the human chicken, his pants seat crammed with sausage links, crouched in a Japanese obeisance upon a silver platter amid a circle of papier-mâché roast potatoes. Grick tucked a sprig of parsley into his coxcomb.
"Grab for the carvers," said Grick. "Grab the carvers off him, if you get the chance."
"Why that?" demanded Walser uneasily.
"In his cups. He can be homicidal."
Then the domed silver dish cover descended upon Walser, plunging him into a metal-smelling, resonant darkness, around which shushed and hissed, like the sound of waves inside a shell, the echoes of the old clown's whisper.
"Homicidal! Homicidal!"
"Here goes," said Grick to Grock.
They picked up the roast between them and tottered with it into the ring. Bufo peered at the great silver dish set down before him with mild surprise. For a moment, just one moment, the heaving, writhing horrors around him settled down into a kind of turbulent tranquillity. The roar of the crowd, the stench of grease paint and naphtha, the weird company of acolytes who surrounded him, raising their faces towards him, comforted him and warned him. And though at any moment a cock might crow thrice, he was, for just this last space of a few heartbeats, 10 or 15, again the loving father about to divide meat between his children. A last touch of grace passed over him. Indeed, was he not the very Christ, presiding at the whiteboard, at supper, with his disciples? But where was the bread? And above all, where were they hiding the wine? He looked round for loaf and bottle, but could see none. An immense suspicion wakened in his red-rimmed eyes. He recalled the carvers in his hands, and lightly clashed the fork against the knife, agitating the bloody streamers in the air. The elastic moment stretched, and stretched further, and stretched too far to sustain its comic tension. The laughter died away. A querulous ripple ran through the crowd. Although Walser in the dish could see and hear nothing, he had already acquired enough of the instinct of the trooper to know that if Bufo were too far gone to unveil the entree must unveil itself. Walser flexed his muscles with pleasure, since his position was exceedingly cramped and uncomfortable, and let out a rousing, The dish cover went bounding and rebounding down the table, sending the rubber settings bouncing this way and that way. Up, Walser rose out of his garnish, like Venus from the foam, spraying parsley and roast potatoes around him, spewing sausages from his trouser vent, and flapping his arms, he sang out again, "Cock-a-doodle-dusky!" Bufo screamed most horribly, and brought the carving knife smashing down.
"Oh, my God!"
said the colonel at the back of the auditorium, clutching Sybil so tight she squealed, champing down so hard on his cigar he bit it in two.
"My God!"
He saw his glory depart, his halo fly away. But Walser, his reflexes exquisitely refined by fear, took a gigantic leap into the air the very moment when, reflected in the dreadful mirror of the eye, he saw the great clown's reason snap. Bufo brought down the carving knife upon only the debris in the silver dish. The bird had flown.
Howls of delight.
The halo fluttered back to hover over the colonel's head again, although now it had an uncertain, impermanent look. Troubled, he spat out the destroyed cigar, fumbled for another, and prompted by a furious convulsion from Sybil, scuttled out to the foyer to summon a doctor. No sooner was the human chicken on its feet again than it took to its heels and sprinted the length of the board. Bufo was detained for a moment as he tugged the carving knife out of the table, for such was the force of his blow the blade had pierced the dish to the wood beneath, and then with a high whinnying scream, he was after him. All present agreed it was a fitting climax to the great clown's career. That chase after the human chicken, round and round the great ring, round as the apple of an eye of the imperial circus in the imperial city of St. Petersburg. How the little dogs enjoyed the fun, snapping and nipping the ankles of hunter and prey, running away with links of sausages, playing football with the roast potatoes, getting under everybody's feet while the other clowns dashed hither and thither, at a loss as to what to do, concerned only to give the illusion of intentional bedlam. For the show must go on, and even if Bufo at last had contrived to plunge his carving knife into the viscera of the human chicken, nobody in that vast gathering of merry folk would ever have been permitted to believe it was real manslaughter. It would have seemed instead the cream of the jest. And now Bufo, in his delirium, began to shake, to shake and shiver most horribly, to most horribly grimace, and to convulse himself in such a way that his immense form seemed to be everywhere at once, dissolving into a dozen buffos, armed with a dozen murderous knives, all streaming rags of blood, and leap and tumble as he might, Walser could find no place in the ring where Buffo was not, and gave up hope for himself. Why didn't Walser run out of the ring the way he'd been carried into it? Because the exit was blocked already by the iron paraphernalia of the princess's cage, and the cats, sniffing blood and madness on the air, were growling uneasily, pacing to and fro, swishing their tails while the two girls stared from between the bars, distraught, until the princess took matters into her own hands and stepped out of the cage with the nozzle of the hosepipe in her hand. The shock of water blasted Buffo back into one single form, blasted him off his feet, blasted him up into the air in the final somersault of his career, and then flattened him on his back. A few moments later, as the crowd held its aching sides and mocked its eyes, Samson, the strong man, hauled prone, soaked, semi-conscious, fearfully hallucinating Buffo off up the gangway that led to the foyer, as little children gave him one last tittering poke for luck, before he vanished as from the face of the earth, while the clowns ran round and round the tiers of seats, kissing babies, distributing bonbons, and laughing, 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 to hide their broken hearts. The frock-coated doctor waited in the champagne bar, accompanied by two stern-faced Mongolian giants, who held a straitjacket invitingly open between them. As the princess lifted the lid of her white piano in the ring, while Mignon flounced her lacy skirts, Buffo, babbling obscenities, was loaded into a waiting cab, leaving the circus for the last time, as he had never done before, in the way that gentlemen did, by the front entrance. Farewell, old man, and from the coffin of your madness there is no escape. Walser, pale, shaking, and once again drenched to the skin, ducked his own dance with the tigress, and sought refuge in Feather's dressing room, only to find the place festering with discord. Lizzie bent over some missive home, leaving the Aerialise to don her costume unaided. Feathers gave Walser brandy and a towel, kindly enough, but only tut-tutted at the terrible story of Buffo's Last Supper in the most perfunctory manner, and it was apparent something quite other than the show was on her mind. Her red satin evening dress swung behind the door, ready, evidently, to take her off to secret delights after the performance was over. The French dwarf's poster, somewhat dog-eared with travelling, flapped on the wall, as if to remind you she was capable of anything. Looking febrile and somehow illicit with excitement, she sat in her dressing gown in front of the mirror. There was a vast diamond bracelet on her right wrist, and she fixed in her ears a pair of earrings, each composed of a stone fit to make the Kohinoor blink. "Larkham," she said, scintillating at Walser. "They're a girl's best friend." Lizzie spluttered derisively at that, and might have spoken, but then such a roar of passionate but unidentifiable emotion came from the distant audience that they could hear it even in their little eyrie above the courtyard. Such a sound as the Roman audience must have made when a lion ate a Christian. Then, the crack of a shot. As the band broke into furious music, came a frantic banging and rattling at the dressing room door. It was the colonel, clutching Sybil like a drowning man, sucking as on a teat on the black stub of an extinguished cigar, tears standing in his veiny eyes. If he had shied away from Feathers for a while, after the debacle of their date, now he came to throw himself on her favour.
"Feathers, my dear, you're on next. Don't wait for the interval. Unexpected turn of events, sudden catastrophe."
He broke down and blubbered like a baby. Feathers rose up impassively, surveying the colonel from the majestic balcony of her bust.
"I say," she said, "be a man and pull yourself together."
From the courtyard below rose up the sound of a great weight being dragged across the cobbles, accompanied by a woman sobbing. Clustering at the window, they witnessed in the dismal light of the moon a dreary procession. First Samson called on for his strength a second time that night, hauling by a rope round her middle the body of Walter's former dancing partner, the tigress, which left a bloody trail behind it, and following on, the tigress's chief mourners, with their shoulders carelessly bare to the freezing night in their white dresses, but both those dresses smeared with blood, and Mignon's hanging from her back in ripped shreds. The princess carried the rifle with which she had shot the tigress, a peerless bullet, straight between the eyes, the moment after, just one moment after, the jealous tigress, deprived of her escort, could bear the sight of Mignon dancing with her mate no longer. The princess shot the tigress the moment after the tigress whirled from her pedestal down amongst the circling cats and got her claws into Mignon's frills. The princess shot the tigress just before she got her claws in Mignon's flesh. All the same, it was Mignon who cried. Feathers shut the window with a clang. The long hairs from the conservatoire had learned their lesson well. The show indeed went on, but the relentless jollity of the circus orchestra did not drown the baying of the crowd. "Cheer up, Colonel," she said. "I'll make them forget. They ain't seen nothing like me before." When she dropped her wrap and donned her plumed topknot, it was as though a huge, not altogether friendly bird appeared among them. She cast a glance at the opulence reflected in the mirror, admired her own bosoms. In the auditorium, they demanded her. She cocked an ear. "Suckers," she said. Lizzie morosely flung the feather cloak over her young friend's shoulders, and the aerialiste stumped out, slamming the door behind her to open it again for a parting shaft. "I'll expect a bonus for this." This time, the slam made the gas jets tremble. "She's in a filthy mood," said Lizzie. "She must and will have supper with this Grand Duke. She won't take a word of advice. Headstrong and mercenary. Headstrong and mercenary. A real Tartar she is. Here, my love," suddenly crooning to the pig. "Does it want a bit of chocky, then?" While she was rummaging in her handbag, the Colonel recovered himself sufficiently to pitch headlong out of the door after Feathers. Having lost two of his star turns already that night, he dared not let his eyes off the Cockney Venus for a second. Sybil, thwarted of her chocolate, protested shrilly from his arms. The plangent strains of a bird in a gilded cage drifted over from the auditorium, as if all were going exactly to plan, as if the circus could absorb madness and slaughter into itself with the enthusiasm of a boa constrictor, and so continue. Walser cast his quick reporter's eye over the room, caught sight of a note tucked into a mirror, picked out two words, "alone" and "unaccompanied," before Lizzie pressed her bundle of papers into his hand, adjuring him to make all haste to catch the diplomatic bag with them, to run and see to it this minute. Had it not been for the sudden sting of jealousy that struck him when he thought of Feathers, alone, unaccompanied, in her gaudy dress, in the Grand Duke's arms, he would, out of sheer curiosity, have stopped to check out Lizzie's letters that she was so anxious to dispatch to London before the circus train pulled out of Petersburg, might even have spotted the code, the secret writing, have found a story there that would have turned him back into a journalist again. As it was, he was too full of misery to care, and let Lizzie, careless of his hurt, push him irritably from the room. As she stowed the bottles and boxes of eyeblack, rouge and powder away in straw hampers, packed rug and hairpins, rolled up the autograph poster, she bubbled with ill-humour like a boiling pot, and when Feathers blew back incandescent with applause, she opened her mouth. "No, no, no," snapped the enormous girl. "Once and for all, you're not to come with me, hobbling along like a rotten old procuress the way you do, you old cow." "Well, you just watch yourself," said Lizzie darkly. "Fucking aristos. Can't trust fucking aristos." Makeup off, unaided, evening dress on, Feathers leaned forward to greet her real face in the mirror with a brilliant smile. "Here today, gone tomorrow. In actual fact, our Lizzie,
We're not even gone tomorrow, but gone to bloody night. Train leaves at midnight, doesn't it? Can't miss that, can I? Not if it were ever so.
She cast a meaningful glance at the stopped clock and giggled.
Pfft, said Lizzie. If you think I'd lift a finger to help you, you got another thing coming, my girl. Sheer greed, that's what it is.
Well, I'm going to touch a sham with a Grand Duke, do I, Liz? Not when the carriage awaits with that, me old duck. Hasn't he said he'll give me the Diamond Riviere to match tonight, just so long as I go by myself? Didn't want you along to cramp my style, you ranted old board. Can you just fasten up me hair?
Lizzie crouched towards the mirror, but could not help herself depositing a kiss on her foster daughter's defenceless nape as she pinned up her curls.
Will you just watch it?
You chuck a hand grenade at the poor old fellow if you got half a chance. For myself, I prefer finesse.
With a conjurer's flourish, she drew out a toy gilt sword from her corset and made some fencer's passes with it.
Remember, I'll go armed into combat, Lizzie. Call it the Nelson touch. Do you think I'd leave my weapon off tonight of all nights?
Lizzie reached out to test the blade with her thumb.
Go for the ballocks, if needs must, she advised, satisfied.
In her red and black lace, it hurt the eyes to look at feathers, and she was, besides, flushed and resplendent with the way she'd just snatched victory from disaster, erased the memory of the madman and the carnivore by the winged miracle of her presence. She was feeling supernatural tonight. She wanted to eat diamonds. At the courtyard gate, a glamorous droshky stood ready to receive her behind the melancholy van from the knacker's yard. As a preferred footman handed feathers into the one, the strong man pitched the carcass into the other. Amid all the bustle and hurry of the dismantling, roustabouts and stable lads dashing this way and that, horses neighing, the refreshed jingling of the elephant's chains as the bullhand slid the great feet into leather boots against the cold, the professor now made an appearance. He carried a bulging carpet bag in one hand and a shiny new briefcase in the other. His colleagues came marching behind. All wore sturdy greatcoats, and one or two had donned the wide sheepskin hats or chapkas of the peasants, bought in the markets to keep their ears warm. All were loaded up with bags, cardboard suitcases, and hat boxes, or carried small trunks on their shoulders. One bore a folded-up blackboard. They were hotly pursued by the agitated colonel. Sybil, under her own steam for once, accompanied him, showing a fair turn of porcine speed. The colonel caught up with the professor, grasped him by the shoulders, and shook him so that he dropped his briefcase. That made the professor terribly angry. He shrieked and gibbered, and the colonel thereupon adopted a conciliatory tone, evidently begging and pleading with him. Sybil got up on her hind legs at one point and laid a beseeching trotter on the professor's forearm. The professor absent-mindedly patted her, but did not stop shaking his head emphatically at the colonel, and produced a piece of paper clotted with sealing wax stamps from his inner pocket. He jabbed a stubby finger at a clause in the contract outlined in red ink and marked in the margin with several exclamation marks. One by one, the stable lads knocked off work to enjoy the argument. The colonel attempted to reason with the professor. The stable lads watched with interest. The professor lost his temper completely, crumpled his paper into a ball, and thrust it down the colonel's throat. The stable lads greeted this action with a burst of ironic cheering and scattered applause. The professor, newly aware of his audience, granted it a jerky little bow. He stroked Sybil's ears, apparently in farewell. Then he and his entire troop precipitated themselves outdoors, leaving the colonel choking. Though one chimp, a green hair ribbon, peeking from beneath her smart tam, looked behind her, even wistfully, perhaps for a last glimpse of Walser. But Walser was off, running Lizzie's messages. When he spat out the contract, the colonel said,
"They're booked in on a night train to Helsinki.
no Siberia for us, he says, or rather scribbles. Come up to me bold as brass after the show, informs me, scrawls a note, dreadful handwriting, dreadful, informs me, they've earned a bonus on account of the applause at the end of their act, lasted longer than 5 minutes, wrote the clause in itself. I signed it to my shame. My watch put the applause at 4 minutes, 99 seconds, precisely. Darned ape won't listen to reason. Darned ape!
The colonel opened his arms to Sybil and pressed his disconsolate face into the pig's neck for comfort, although Sybil, loyalties somewhat torn, snorted thoughtfully to herself. And the apes were by no means the only defectors that night. Many a stable lad, already sufficiently glutted with adventure, went under the net, using his earnings to purchase a ticket at the Finland station and roll off through the pine forests on the way home. Bufo the Great was incarcerated in a Russian madhouse. The Tigress lay in a Petersburg knacker's yard. It was a depleted company the colonel would take across the tundra, towards the islands where the sun was already rising, and that night he almost lost his star as well. Chapter 11. Amidst a fine masculine smell of leather upholstery, lapped to the eyes in a rug of sables, feathers rolled through the beautiful city as the snow came whirling down in huge soft flakes. The old woman, the big babushka in the sky, was shaking her mattress overhead, shaking it with great abandon, as if preparing a feather bed for a gargantuan coupling. Snow whirled down onto the Neva, there to dissolve upon the ice-sickened water. Some snow clung to the crowns and folded forearms of the civic monuments, to the carved cornices of pediment and portico, to the mane and tail of the mount of the stone horseman, a white transforming fall, the first touch of winter, a visitation that arrives with such a magical caress, you can scarcely believe at first how the winter of these latitudes will kill you at its vast leisure, if it gets the chance. But Feathers saw no death in the snow. All she saw was that festive sparkle of the frosty lights that made her think of diamonds. She hugged the sable rug about her as she climbed the skidding steps to his front door under an umbrella the coachman held above her head. A couple of capripede caryatids looked after the door, and there was a coat of arms above it, a unicorn goring a knight. The street was deserted. Yellow street lamps sifted the inexorable snow. The coachman bowed and vanished, leaving Feathers to tug on the melodious doorbell by herself. The Grand Duke did her the honour of letting her in. So, all the servants had been sent away for the night, had they? "I want the carriage back at 11:30 p.m. precisely," she informed him crisply, dropping his sables on the floor. "Let him pick that up himself if he wanted." His house was the realm of minerals, of metals, of vitrification, of gold, marble, and crystal. Pale halls and endless mirrors and glittering chandeliers that clanged like wind bells in the draught from the front door. And a sense of frigidity, of sterility, almost palpable, almost tangible in the hard, chill surfaces and empty spaces. "Always the same," thought Feathers censoriously. "Money is wasted on the rich." For herself, if she'd been as Croesus wealthy as her host, she'd have fancied something like the Brighton Pavilion to call home, something to make each passerby smile, a reciprocal gift to those from whom the wealth had come. And conversely, she went on to herself, sneering at the Grand Duke's palace, poverty is wasted on the poor, who never know how to make the best of things, are only the rich without money, are just as useless at looking after themselves, can't handle their cash just like the rich can't, always squandering it on bright, pretty, useless things in just the same way. Let me tell you something about Feathers, if you haven't noticed it for yourself already. She's a girl of philosophical bent. Since money it is that makes us rich or poor, why then, abolish money, she sometimes said to Lizzie. For all that money is a symbolic means of facilitating exchanges that should by rights be freely made, or not at all. But Lizzie would whistle through her moustache at Feather's naivety and reply, "The baker can't make a loaf out of your privates, ducky, and that's all you'd have to offer him in exchange for a crust if nature hadn't made you the kind of spectacle people pay good money to see. All you can do to earn your living is to make a show of yourself. You're doomed to that. You must give pleasure of the eye or else you're good for nothing. For you, it's always a symbolic exchange in the marketplace. You couldn't say you were engaged in productive labour, now could you, girl?" "But neither does this one toil nor spin," thought Feathers, in the Grand Duke's palace. "Yet he is so rich that money hasn't any meaning for him. The sums he's about to squander on this bright, pretty, useless thing, myself, have nothing to do with my value as such. If all the women in the world had wings, he'd keep his jewels to himself to play at ducks and drakes on the icy waters of the Neva. My value to him is as a rara avis." In his marble halls, she smiled like a predator. "Here comes Property Redistribution, Inc., to take away your diamonds, Grand Duke." She stalked up an outflung arc of marble staircase, the Grand Duke attentively behind her, his eyes fixed on the throbbing bulges at the base of her shoulders. And as she proceeded, she priced the candle holders, the mirrors, the oriental jars, even the hothouse blooms within them. She made the progress of an auctioneer, and with every step, added a further sum to the price she'd already put upon whatever entertainment she might be asked to provide. His study was more ruminative, a steep-sided oval room with a mezzanine gallery wreathed in shadow. Busts of Dante, Shakespeare and Pushkin atop the bookcases looked down upon a table laid for an intimate supper. Little glasses for vodka, funnels for champagne, and in the middle, something to make her gasp. Herself in ice. And life-size. At full spread, styling and smiling, a cold masterpiece that would have turned into a puddle of ice by the time that Dawn would find her chugging across the Tiger, as she again promised herself it would. The ice sculpture stood on the tip of one foot, in a black gravel of caviar, and round its neck there blazed away the thousand rainbow facets of the most magnificent parure she'd ever seen. Oh, the incendiary stones! Her fingers itched to snatch it. But she could scarcely burst out of her bodice, flutter up and make off with it before so much as the soup was served, could she? She was a well-bred girl after all, wasn't she? She choked on balked greed. She felt a sulk might be coming on. "Well," she said, and sank down on a sofa, drawing off her long black gloves for the sake of something to do. The Grand Duke seized hold of one hand as soon as it was bare and pressed his bearded mouth to the palm, giving her a sensation of hot, wet, turbulent, unpleasant hairiness. "May you melt in the warmth of my house, just as she melts," he murmured, with a nod to the ice sculpture. "That chance," thought Feathers, retrieving her hand and wiping onto her napkin the trace of saliva he'd left behind. She did not like his greeting. She cast an uneasy glance at the ice sculpture, to make sure it had not started to melt already. He was a man of medium height in a green velvet smoking jacket of exquisite cut. His French matched his style. He possessed an infinite number of versts of black earth, pine forest, and barren tundra, beneath which bubbled oil. Feathers kept her Spanish shawl wrapped tight. She refrained from catching his eye. He thought she was overawed by everything. She priced with astonishment the worn old Persian carpet underfoot, and added another naught to the price in sterling of tossing him off. He offered her vodka. She was glad of a drink, but wary of the pile of glasses behind the bottle. Did he intend to ask his friends in? But now, smiling, he arranged the glasses into a series of Roman letters. She watched what he was at with slitted, suspicious eyes, until it dawned on her that he was writing the letters of her name with vodka glasses. Her christened name, S-O-P-H-I-A. But How does he know that?
Who were, she thought. The familiar goose walking over a grave feeling that Tom Tit-Tot suffers in the old story. She hated to be called by strangers, Sophia.
"In old Russian custom,"
he said, giving her a stiff little bow,
"in your honour."
Then he filled up all the glasses to the brim with vodka.
"He's never..."
One by one, he knocked each back. She counted, mesmerized. 35, and still on his feet. At this point, she formed the opinion the Grand